bad economics drove out better economics because the bad economics was easier to understand.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. The dollar a day poverty line was created for the World Bank's 1990 World Development Report. The question of what exactly it measures has been argued ever since. A new paper, soon to be published in the Journal of Development Economics, argues that this low bar indicator has warped the policy response to poverty, and it proposes a radically different poverty line. Land Pritchett of the School of Public Policy at the London School of Economics is one of the authors. He joins me now to explain what the authors propose, why they are proposing it, and what difference it may make to the way we think about who exactly is poor. Land, welcome back to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks for having me again.
You are very welcome, especially on this topic, which I know is one that you feel very strongly about. So let's go back in history, Land, because the dollar a day poverty line has been with us for almost four decades now. What was the origin of this?
Well, I was actually there at the creation, as they say. I was in the World Bank's development economics unit, which is the research unit, and it's responsible for producing the World Development Report. And when I read the first drafts of the World Development Report and they were proposing using dollar a day, I was a kid, maybe 2 years into the bank, and the director was Lynn Squire, very senior. I got to him and said, this poverty line's crazy. It's just crazy too low. Like, yes, everyone below this line is poor, but billions of people with higher incomes than this line are also poor by perfectly legitimate and reasonable ways.
Mm-hmm.
And he sort of dismissed my concern, saying, look, we're going to write a report on global poverty. We need a number for global poverty. And this dollar a day poverty line is just going to produce that number. Don't worry about it. I think in the long run, I was right to be concerned that this number would have more influence than just producing a headline number for the number of poor for a 1990 report.
Yeah, which is exactly what we're going to talk about today. And his advice for you not to worry about it, that clearly didn't stick. Given, as you say, the fact that it came in very, very, very low, why did this line become so strongly identified with the fight against global poverty, and not just identified by economists, but by the general public with the fight against global poverty?
I think there are good reasons and bad reasons. The good reason is there's no question that it conveys urgency. If you say a person in the world is living on dollar a day and you illustrate the consequences for that, for people's possibilities to have decent housing and access to water and get their kids educated,
mm-hmm.
There's no question that the lower the line, the more urgency you can generate. That's a good thing. That's a good reason why it may have succeeded. I also think there are some very bad reasons, which is it also completely got the rich countries off the hook. It excludes people who are legitimately poor. And so the way in which a low bar poverty line puts more emphasis on the poor is by giving zero, exactly mathematically zero emphasis to everybody else. So by saying currently the people in the second decile in Bangladesh aren't poor, which means if I'm a rich person citizen and I'm thinking about world distribution, I said, no, look, the Bangladeshis can solve the extreme poverty problem on their own. I can just redistribute from rich Bangladeshis to poor Bangladeshis. So to some extent, it's extremely convenient for the rich and powerful countries to have a low bar poverty line because it kind of takes global redistribution off the table until an aid agency from Denmark can recommend that Bangladesh have redistributed programs within Bangladesh, because the extent to which a second decile of Bangladeshi and the median Dane count towards reducing poverty is exactly the same. They both count for zero. So this exclusion was actually an economic bug, but a political feature.
This is what's called the focus axiom, where if you're just a tiny little bit above the poverty line and you get less poor it doesn't show up in the figures.
Yeah, by construction. It is an axiom of poverty measurement.
So, this isn't the first time people had tried to measure poverty or try to estimate the impact of relieving poverty. There were methods before that gave distributional weights to people. So if you were very poor, then it was very important to relieve your poverty. If you're slightly less poor, slightly less important. This seems like a sensible way of doing things. Why was that chucked out the window?
Legibility. Legibility has become a very popular word in politics, which kind of in its best meaning just means, can people understand it instantly? So I emphasize that, look, if you go back to the 1970s, the World Bank was obsessed with redistribution.
Mm-hmm.
Like the first holder of the, you know, vice president of development economics, Hollis Chenery, wrote together with Montakalawalia, who went on to be a very famous Indian policymaker, a book called Redistribution with Growth. That was the central ideological stance of the World Bank. So the idea that we economists ignored distribution until poverty came along is exactly wrong. Redistribution was a huge issue from the minute development was born until poverty was invented. What poverty has, it's just easier to understand. Everybody says there's 1.1 billion poor, 56 million of them are in Ethiopia. Those are numbers they can understand because everybody understands numbers about people because they are a person, right? And so I think this is a case of kind of Gresham's law. Bad economics drove out better economics because the bad economics was easier to understand. You just draw this line, you're poor, you're not poor. This gives us a number of poor, this intuitively easily capturable thing that people felt was going to give more prioritization to poverty. But it wasn't economists were like, all that matters is GDP growth and distribution doesn't matter. That's a complete myth.
But if you speak to more or less any development economist about this today, they would side with Young Lant on this to say, this is not an appropriate measure. It doesn't really measure poverty. And it shouldn't really be a basis for policy. Isn't today the indicator, which survives, no longer at a dollar a day, it has now been adjusted upwards, but isn't it still more about catching people's attention and certainly capturing media attention?
It's a very dangerous game to play. The problem is, if the World Bank says our goal is to end poverty and we define poverty with this metric, then people can legitimately come back and say, oh, but that's inconsistent with your financing this bridge, because how does this bridge really help the poor? And this is inconsistent with your giving large loans to Indonesia, because Indonesia has next to no poor on the dollar a day standard. So we live in a world where, yes, we can get attention, but if you get attention on a premise that you can't or aren't institutionally and organizationally deliberate, that's a very dangerous game to play. And I think in the long run, part of the erosion of support for development assistance bilaterally and globally is you got a lot of attention on, oh, we're going to eliminate extreme poverty, but then it got eliminated in large parts of the world by just broad-based economic growth, not specifically transfer programs. But as that happened, people thought, okay, let's wind this sucker down, right? We're done. Or you got Oxfam in the UK saying, tell me how exactly these huge loans that are going to Indonesia and Brazil are affecting global poverty when they have almost no global poor. Sometimes people will tell me on this poverty issue that I'm taking them literally where I shouldn't take it literally. I don't think you should be in the position of asking things to be taken seriously that you can't take literally. If you want poverty to be taken seriously, you should have measures of poverty that you can take literally.
So, in the interest of taking this both seriously and literally, you have proposed something different, a global upper bound poverty line, an upper bound. What is the conceptual basis of this?
The conceptual basis is that I feel we should have an array of poverty lines.
Mm-hmm.
So, I am not criticizing the dollar a day line as a role of, this is the lowest a poverty line can be. And if you're below this line, you are honest to God, for sure poor. And it plays mm-hmm. a useful role. So I'm not about ending any use for the low bar line. But the problem is everybody acknowledges that almost all national poverty lines are higher than the global lower bound. Developing countries have national poverty lines that are higher, and those are legitimate poverty lines for their purposes. So we should acknowledge the legitimacy of those lines. And once we have an array of lines, well, an array either has an upper bound or it doesn't. Part of it is, let's do the flip side of the concept of the lower bound. If we think of the lower bound of saying, you honest to God, if you're below this, you are poor, but above this, you might also be poor. Let's do the opposite. Let's say, what's the line where honest to God, if you're above that, you're not poor by any reasonable standard?
Right.
Right? And so that's the upper bound. And then our proposal in practice is going to be, let's have the lower bound, let's have national poverty lines, and let's have a global upper bound. And let's work with countries as development actors and economists to think about reducing all of those variants of poverty. Let's have the lower bound to deal with extreme, you know, chronic poverty. Let's have a national poverty line to deal with important redistributional issues. And let's have an aspirational poverty line where countries say, I would like everybody in my country to also be above this line. And then we have a strategy that balances an array of notions of poverty, which, by the way, is what the Sustainable Development Goal adopted in 2015 says. Let's end poverty in all its forms. Let's have an upper bound that defines, if you're above that, you're really not poor by a globally legitimate metric. That's the origin of our conceptual drive.
So that's the concept. How could you then define this in a way that you can go about estimating it?
To estimate it, we think of it in two ways. In our paper, we say, look, measures of well-being tend to have a concave relationship with aggregate income. Meaning, if we take a measure of the basics of human well-being, that improves a lot from low levels and then plateaus out. So above a certain level, additional income isn't contributing to basics. And if we take most measures of poverty, they look like this kind of a hump shape that plateaus at high levels.
Mm-hmm.
And the flip side of that is the slope of that relationship does the opposite. It starts very high and gets very low. So at some level of income, the increment to your well-being from that income gets very low. So we say, let's define poverty in two ways. One, on the level of well-being, you're above thresholds of adequateness that would be adequate for a person in a rich country. And on the flip side, your increment to this well-being from additional income gets very low, because that way the focus axiom and reality get close. If the focus axiom says above this poverty line, we're going to count your income to zero, then we should choose an upper bound poverty line where that's empirically true. Where more income, you would like it, but it's not essential. That's our flip side. We say, let's define a poverty line where your level of well-being on a variety of well-being measures is high-ish by global standards, so not as high as Switzerland, but maybe as high as Greece. And at the same time, because we've gone high, we're on a part of the relationship that's kind of plateaued out, which means the incremental benefit is low. And since the incremental benefit is low, having a poverty measure that counts gains above that as zero isn't a huge bug. It is not a huge, terrible feature. And so if we can pick a line where both of those are roughly true, that's a good upper bound line. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. We're getting better at measuring well-being. So if you come up with an estimate, whatever that estimate is, what do you test it against and how do you test it?
On the marginal side, we just say, let's take the incremental gain to well-being at the low bar line. And that's super high.
Yeah.
And then let's take the ratio of that as income goes high. And we think, let's get near enough satiation. There isn't really satiation in income. But if we think the marginal gain to income is 3% at a poverty level of what it was at the low bar poverty line, that's pretty near zero. So again, we're across these different measures, we're not going to have a consistent threshold. But it's, you know low when you see it, right? And what we show is that the current World Bank upper bound poverty lines, like $6.85,
the marginal utility is still at roughly 30% of what it was at the low bar poverty line. So you haven't gone far enough out in income where you could say this is inconsequentially low. Whereas if you say, you know, yes, there's still gains from having more income, but it's 3% of what it was for the poor. Okay, that's small enough that if we round that to zero, we're not doing huge injustice to empirical reality. By and large, we tend to choose on the level side something like the 80th percentile of a global distribution.
Like, you know, if we say access to basics, right? Basics like shelter, electricity, water. If we can create an index of that and then say we rate that from 0 to 100, if you look at the data, kind of Argentina is around 80. And you think, oh, yeah, that's kind of a level at which people basics are met. So it's, we're not putting you against the world's richest countries as the standard. We're just saying, you know, it should be high in a way that a middle-class global person thinks, yeah, I'm materially well-situated.
And you in the paper have come up with a number of $21.50, $21.50.
Yeah.
For this. How did you come up with that number?
Well, we come up with that because we have four different measures of empirical well-being.
Yeah.
One is just actual marginal utility with parameterized that are used from a large empirical literature estimating that parameter. One is a food share, you know, the fraction you spend on food. No one would argue somebody spending 50% of their budget on food, it doesn't have high marginal utility of income. One is kind of access to basics, an indicator that we use at the national level. And one is we take household data and we say a household to be non-poor should have these six things.
Okay.
It should have electricity. It shouldn't have children dying. It should have its children educated. It should have six characteristics that the demographic and health surveys routinely have. And then we say at what level of income, and it's actually assets in the demographic and health survey data, but we map that into income. At what level of the distribution do households reliably have those six things? And they're pretty basic things. Like, we try and say, it would be absurd to say this person is well off, but they don't have this.
Uh-huh.
I think if you say this person's well off, but they don't have electricity, people go, nah, that's just dumb.
Oh, yeah.
People are well off, but their kids aren't in school. Nah, that's just dumb. We try and use the that's just dumb standard. But the important thing is these are four completely separate metrics of well-being, and then we use these two criteria. And when we do that, we get, I think, a remarkably robust sense that when we say, what's the number at which you reach the level? What's the number at which the marginal has gone near enough satiation? We tend to get numbers across all the countries and all the indicators between $20 a day and $40 a day. Sometimes we get like $17 a day. Sometimes the method just doesn't work and the marginal is increasing even at very high levels. But, you know, it's never going to settle on a single number. But I was actually impressed that we didn't get numbers in the 5 range and we didn't get numbers typically in the 55 range, between 20 and 40. And then we settled on 21.5 for exactly the reason you settle on dollar a day. It's a focus number because the current low bar line is 2.15. So 21.5 has the focal property of being exactly 10 times as high. If you're picking a number from a range, if you came back and said, no, it should be 23.2, I'd say you're right, but you're stupid. You're right, 23.2 is the true average of these numbers, but 21.5 is 10 times 2.15 and 10 times, for the same reason that they used 1, I'm going to use 10. It's a focal point. Dollar a day only became popular because it was a focal point. So we're just taking advantage that in our kind of solidly in our range is a nice focal point like 10.
I'm going to be careful what I come to you and suggest in the future.
Academics can be right and stupid at the same time. We are all the time.
So if we take your upper bound at 21.50 and we say that people below that upper bound are, in our conceptualization of this, in some way poor, what proportion of people in developing countries, even in rich countries, are poor?
First of all, in rich countries, almost no one is poor by that standard.
Uh-huh.
Denmark, I just happened to be looking at the numbers for Denmark. Denmark, it's like 2.8% are poor. The 2% of Danes are in material deprivation. It's not an unreasonable thing. I mean,
So in truly rich countries, it's very, very low.
Mm-hmm.
But in lots of middle-income countries, essentially everyone is poor. And we're not hiding the fact that 99% of the population of Pakistan is poor by this poverty line. And I think that's right. If you look at the numbers about the global income distribution, again, we tend to think of the rich in Pakistan, but if you compare the 90th percentile in Pakistan, it is considerably poorer than the 10th percentile in Denmark. So again, if we apply a global standard, we are saying that, yeah, Denmark, praise be, very few people are poor. But if we adopt that standard for Danes and apply it to Pakistanis, the data tell us nearly every Pakistani is in a form of material conditions that doesn't meet a global standard of being not poor. And I think that's right. And we're not conflating the low bar line. We're not saying everybody in Pakistan is in extreme, urgent, desperate poverty, but they are in a condition of material well-being that could be improved and it'd be called poverty reduction in a legitimate and important sense.
So, Len, tell me how we implement this as policy. If we have the entire population of Pakistan as poor, and the World Bank needs to have lending policies to help deal with poverty, how does this change what organizations like the World Bank actually do?
First of all, I think what the World Bank should have always been focused on is broad-based economic growth, or what I now call inclusion into productivity. Meaning one of the policy distortions of these low bar lines is they emphasized on inclusion into consumption and acted as if redistribution within Pakistan could solve the poverty problem. Whereas once you acknowledge that nearly everyone in Pakistan needs to be above a certain threshold to be considered globally not poor, you're back to saying we need processes of broad-based inclusive productivity and economic growth. And so I think that's a terrific thing, and the World Bank can say that. That said, two specific technical things. One, Art Cray and a number of other authors at the World Bank have come up with something called the prosperity gap.
Right. Yes.
So if you think of the World Bank's goals as being poverty reduction and shared prosperity, there's a measure of shared prosperity that weighs the whole distribution. So it doesn't have this threshold feature of being zero above a threshold. And so I think using of the prosperity gap as a way of saying we care about distribution, just like we did in the 1970s, we're not saying more gains to poorer people aren't more important than gains to richer people within Pakistan, but we shouldn't say the second decile of Bangladesh doesn't matter to our goals. That's obscene. That's stupid. Now, the second thing is, once we have a headcount, remember, the poverty line defines a whole array of measures of poverty. And the headcount is the most legible of them. You know, 99% of people in Pakistan are poor. But if you think about the standard poverty measures, there's a poverty gap measure and a squared poverty gap measure that, again, give more weight the further you are from the line. So I'm not saying the World Bank should adopt 21.5 and only care about 21.5. I'm saying both with a prosperity gap measure and with more sophisticated poverty measures using a higher poverty line, you come up with reasonable approaches that say we should focus on improving the incomes of everyone with higher priority if we can achieve improvements of income of poorer people rather than richer people. That's a super sensible way to do it. And I believe this is a way the World Bank can actually act in partnership with developing country governments. Because one of the things about the low bar poverty line is you couldn't both say the World Bank is a partner in Pakistan's development, but by the way, our organizational goal only includes 5% of your people.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what I'm saying is, let's have a strategy jointly developed between development actors and governments and more broadly with participation of the citizens for their well-being that has particular focus on the poorest of the poor, additional focus on the national poor, but is still aspirational for broad-based improvement for everyone. That seems like a basis in which a democratic government and developing country can say, here is our strategy and here's why, and here is how what we're going to ask development actors to bring to us is help in achieving this broad-based strategy.
Earlier, you said that you would support having a range of poverty lines. Does that have any place in this strategy?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm advocating, I'm not against keeping track of dollar a day poverty in India, but acting as if that's the main metric of development projects, it just isn't, never should have been. No one ever argued it was. If you go back to 1990, it was argued this is the lowest a poverty line could be. It was never argued it was the poverty line. It never argued it was the best poverty line. It never argued anything about it. My strategy is using an array. Let's use dollar a day, 2.15. Let's use 21.5 as the range of developmentally related poverty lines. Countries have their own poverty lines. Let's use a combination of those three with each country to articulate what's a strategy that's going to address poverty in all its forms, and particularly in the most relevant forms in your country.
Is it possible that your intervention here might be appropriate, but incredibly unwelcome at a time when funding for anti-poverty programs is being cut? And the last thing that policymakers would want to hear is suddenly they have millions more poor people in their country than was previously being reported.
I think countries will love it. Donors might hate it. Yes, if you were a development philanthropist that wanted to feel really important in the world because you had managed to define the problem to such incredibly penurious, low bar standards that you could make a difference, you're not going to like this. But I don't care about you. I care about Kenyans, I care about Indians, I care about Bangladeshi, I care about Indonesians, and they are not well served by a low bar line. The crazy thing is, the most exclusionary thing going on in the world is the dollar a day poverty line. It excludes as relevant to the importance of the development enterprise most of the people on the planet, with no good reason. So I think an inclusive poverty line, it might be unpopular if you take this approach, and if you were worried, you know, about a billionaire taking pictures with all the people you lifted out of poverty. I like billionaires well enough, but they're not my main priority. Unless and until countries actually get more productive and generate more of their own resources, we're not really going to solve the important problems. And so economizing on the tiny amount that the rich world makes available for development aid, it's just not the important thing. Make a list of the 10 most populous developing countries: India, China, Indonesia, Pakistan, Egypt, Bangladesh, Vietnam. Ask them how much they care about development aid. I think if you went to the government of India and said all of bilateral development assistance is going to disappear tomorrow, meh.
Lant, always fascinating talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
So the paper's called Raising the Bar, an Inclusive Global Poverty Line, and the authors Lant Pritchett and Martina Villarengo. You can find it now in its working paper form. You can find it later in the Journal of Development Economics. Download it, read it, and argue about it with your colleagues. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts, our past episodes, as always, at voxdev.org, where there are articles about the topics we feature. If you like what you've just heard, please pass it on. Tell someone else about it. Leave us a review as well. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.